6.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. When you go to a 3 or 4 star restaurant, do you know who's cooking your food? Do you want to know? After reading the chef Anthony Bourdain, you won't ever want to assume that it's a mild-mannered line of French-trained grill chefs or well-spoken cold station attendants. As Anthony Bourdain writes, restaurant kitchens are filled with hardworking psychopaths, misfits, and other crazies, the kind of people you'd want to have at your side in a war. To people who love the business of cooking, it feels like a warm bath. To an outsider watching meal preparation at Le Halle restaurant on Park Avenue South in New York, where Anthony Bourdain is the chef, it could look like triage. The scene is a quick-moving mass of pans, slippery hands holding sharp knives, hot plates and slips of paper, 6 burners going at once, dishwashers up to their ears in serving plates and utensils. The discourse is not the stuff of family radio, but it may have everything to do with feeding a hungry public. Connection listeners, who knows this world of talented throat cutters, fire starters, hooligans? Did you ever work in the restaurant biz and come to miss the nightlife, the swearing, the immigrant culture so much that you're ready again to quit your desk job? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. The Kitchen Confidential connection with Anthony Bourdain, who started last year writing the truth about kitchens in the New Yorker magazine. He's now written Kitchen Confidential in hardcovers, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And welcome, Anthony Bourdain. You've written about System D in the moment when you picked it up from people working with you and you said, what is System D? Explain to all of us, what is System D?
Well, I heard my French sous chef using it. I think he saw a busboy trying to fix a milk dispenser with a butter knife or something like that. And he goes, ah, le système D. And I thought, wow, this is great. I have to check into this. And I went back. I think I read Orwell, reread Down and Out in Paris and London. And just was very curious as if this was some mysterious phrase, a concept that I'd been unaware of in 28 years in the business. I asked him to explain. I said, well, what is this System D? Orwell explains it as standing for débrouillard or démerdé, somebody who gets you out of the weeds, somebody, an extractor, a sort of a Sergeant Bilko-type character, the ability to get you out of trouble any way possible. But my French sous chef said, you know MacGyver? And I said, yes. He said, ça, c'est le système D.
What's the worst trouble that a master of System D can get you out of?
Oh, well, equipment breakage, running out of food, suddenly need a new body at the saute station. Master System D, my sous chef of many years was terrific in that if my Cuisinart or my Robocoupe broke in the middle of the shift, he could slip out the back door, show up in 5 minutes with a spanking new one with another restaurant's shallot still in it. That's the sort of thing I look for in a sous chef.
And you don't ask too many questions.
No, not in the restaurant business. So not when you need a new Robocoup in the middle of the shift.
There's a legendary name in French cooking. It's one of the great stories, actually. Vatel. And I wish you'd just sort of recount it.
Well,
the tragedy of Monsieur Vatel.
Yes, there's some dispute over the accuracy of the story, but the received version is that Vatel was a chef who I believe a king or some royal type. Just thrown an enormous dinner party for hundreds of people, was informed that he had another big mass of people coming a little later, and as he was strolling around the gardens of this estate. Bumped into his fish purveyor, who informed Chef Vatel that the fish delivery would not be arriving on time. And Vatel went back to his room, it is said, placed a sword into a door jamb and fell upon it, killing himself. Rather than mess up dinner, he took the honorable way out. So this in the legend of haute cuisine, this elevated the humble cook to a more exalted figure in the public eye. Of course, if you ask many Frenchmen, they'll say, well, he killed himself over a woman. It was, had nothing to do with the fish.
But part of the legend was that the fish showed up.
Yes, shortly after his death, the story goes, the fish supply did indeed show up, but Vatel was not around to enjoy it.
There's a commentary on it, on that story, by Phileas Gilbert, who was brutal about Vatel's loss of nerve. And his comment was this. He said, "If we chefs de cuisine, whose coat sleeve may be decorated with four or five stripes, each indicating 10 years of service, recalled our experiences, we could all remember disasters which suddenly strike the catering services, and which, according to Vatel's example, would call for harakiri. But recourse to the cook's knife would solve nothing, and it is in such difficult circumstances that firmness of character emerges in the one who commands. He should find within himself unerring judgment, an iron will, a high sense of responsibility, and the experience which dictates prompt and energetic decisions. Such a one will never lose his head and would not dream of committing suicide. An authoritative appeal to the goodwill of his team, temporarily at a loss, some brief and clear orders called out over the tumult of the upset pots and pans, and the problem is resolved. The service continues."
I couldn't agree more. Clearly, Vatel would have been well served by a sous chef who was a practitioner of System D. That would have obviated that situation.
You wrote in a piece, and it's part of the book, "Given the choice between a young, hotel school-trained, French-experienced would-be Ducasse and a Mexican débrouillard who has worked his way up the line from a dishwashing position, a graduate of the System D University, I'll take the ex-dishwasher every time."
No question. Every time. And I'd go further. I would almost always choose a Mexican ex-dishwasher who's worked his way up the line over a graduate of my own culinary school, an American kid. Much lower
You're tough
maintenance,
on your stool.
better. No, great school, best cooking school in the country. Set a level of excellence for the trade. I just think it's a character issue. You know what? Americans are more high maintenance, require more head patting and stroking and regular sort of psychological tune-ups. And for whatever reason, I've just had, you know, over the years, fabulous experiences with persons not born in this country. You know, better attitude, better work ethic, and tremendous. I just met a number of really tremendous cooks. The best, I often say, the best French and Italian cooks in New York are Mexicans and Ecuadorians. And it's a shame that there aren't more Mexican and Ecuadorian French chefs. There should be.
That's an important point in the book. This book and your work in The New Yorker was taken as sort of scandalous. I mean, all the business about recycled bread and butter, that kind of thing. We'll have to get to that. But I read this book as a kind of hymn to immigrant labor, a whole class of Hispanic, I mean, Brazilians, Colombians. And I wish you'd talk about them. Talk about them. You talk about them as a group, but I wish you'd talk about them individually.
Well, you know, it's what I would miss more than anything else in the business is the music, the sort of poetry of just the sounds of the kitchen, the way we talk to each other in the kitchen.
Can we hear it?
And I don't think on the radio it's, you know, indescribably obscene for the most part. It sounds in my kitchen, the level of discourse is pretty much like Mexican prison slang, or Spanglish. And, you know, with the clatter of the pots in the background and the hiss and spray of the dishwasher and people sort of insulting each other in this never-ending game of the dozens, you know, my horrible Spanish, their perfect Spanish and bad English, a little bit of French, a little bit of Bengali slang. It's beautiful to me. And of course, since you know, when you're locked up in a kitchen with the same people like a submarine crew for year after year, you develop very, very close relationships with people. And you know, I often say if I need a favor at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm not calling a writer. You know, I'm calling a cook. You know, those are the people I can rely on.
The heroes, I mean, the people you write about by name, and you may have changed them, but they're all, the names are Segundo, Miguel, Hubert, but they're Mohammed.
Yeah. You know, these are
Who are
people.
these people?
Let's see. Mohammed was an Egyptian dishwasher who worked his way up the line. Then there's a Mohammed, also a Mohammed, a runner I refer to in the article. He's an incredible food runner and expediter who's currently working at Layal in New York,
What's a food runner?
Bangladesh. He's a guy who shuttles food from the kitchen and takes it out to the table, presumably in the correct order and to the correct positions at the table. He also does some expediting, meaning calling out to the kitchen when to fire or you know, order and fire various tables and dishes. And he performs another many other tasks that sort of fall into that gray area of nobody else is doing them. He's an amazingly capable character. I changed some of the Spanish names in the article. But these guys, all of them in my kitchen now, have all come up from dishwasher. They've been trained by a succession of French, despotic French chefs. Incredibly capable. I mean, they may not know if you ask them about a Soubise or a Duxelles, maybe they don't know the word. But they sure know how to make it, and they know how to make it better than most Frenchmen I know. There's a joke in my kitchen. Some of the Mexicans go, "Oh, let's cook French style," meaning put it in the microwave. They sneer at it too. I mean, they won't cut corners, like many many Americans and many French. They will hang on and do it right every time. It's just
What
really
drives
impressive.
them? What are they in it for? What are they making?
I
Who
think.
are they competing with?
Good money these days. The days, at least in New York, in the level of cooking that I've been doing over the last couple of decades, the day of the underpaid, hideously exploited immigrant laborer are really to a great extent coming to an end. These guys are competing directly with Americans coming out of culinary schools, and in most cases, winning the contest. Why do they do it? I think because no one understands the American dream of working hard, moving up the ladder, and making a good life for yourself, than people who weren't born in America. People of my generation, I mean, I grew up thinking that it was an automatic right that I would live better than my parents. And I believed that, well into my first year dishwashing, at which point I sort of changed my views.
1-800-423-8255 makes the kitchen connection with Anthony Bourdain. This is not the world of the Food Network. It's not the world of celebrity cooks either. Well, the celebrities, the heroes are all the people you're talking about.
For me, the heroes are line cooks. I mean, this book was written from the point of view of the line cook in the trenches, not somebody with their own show on the TV Food Network. I will never have my own show. You would be very foolish to make me the host of a show on the TV Food
Were you
Network.
trying to drive customers away?
No, and in fact, the book has been touted as sort of an expose. I mean, anyone who's dunked French fries for 2 months at a summer job in a restaurant, knows the bread story, the fish on Monday business. I mean, this is all nonsense. And this was written, I guess, for atmosphere and a little authenticity, so for fellows in the business. And I admit, I kind of enjoy goosing the general dining public a little bit.
1-800-423-8255 with Anthony Bourdain, who's written Kitchen Confidential out of his own 15 years working the very upmarket kitchens of New York. 1-800-423-TALK. Moses is calling from Lake Placid, New York. Hello,
Hi,
Moses. Welcome.
hi. Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking the call. It's refreshing to hear somebody talk about the restaurant business in its true light. The term trench is truly a word that's applicable to working in a kitchen. One of the things that I most agree with him on is the fact that there are just nobody coming into this industry any longer that has that desire to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. The aggravation, not only from the
Somebody's coming into it. You mean no American-born suburban kids?
Basically so. As you said, the kids that come out of the culinary schools, they want to start at the top and work themselves down, which they usually do, because after the first 2 weeks on the job, they realize that it's not all fluff and fauna. It's very hard work, very hard work. And again, it's great to hear that somebody's telling the practical side of it. I've been in the business, doing it for 35 years. I had a restaurant that served tons and tons of food. Now, my wife and I have a little small inn in Lake Placid. It's just she and I, because we don't rely on other people.
It's tremendous. So you know what it's like. It's it's great hearing from cooks and chefs and people in the business. I think it's been the most satisfying part of writing this book is that people in the life are apparently getting it. So thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for taking the call.
Moses, it's a pleasure. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255 with Anthony Bourdain. Basil is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Basil.
Oh, I love your show, and this topic is great. It's I cooked for a number of years, and as it would have it, I lived just down the road from Lake Placid, and when I first went into the business, I worked for a man named Moses, but not this guy.
What are the odds?
Yeah, what are the odds? Couldn't imagine. Well, it has something to do with the business in Lake Placid, maybe. I don't know. It's a tourist town, high turnover of people. But what I had to say, what rang really true, was that in the intro you mentioned camaraderie, the trenches. It very much is. Being a line cook, I remember working with a guy named Tony, shall I say his last name, the insults back and forth. Insult the chef and they go back and forth. The fun.
There's that ghetto game of the dozens, you know, where it's sort of an escalating rondelay of
yeah,
insults.
Give us a sample.
Oh, God. Oh, Roger, I see you passed your AIDS test.
Yeah, we sniffle, you know, what is your major malfunction? Well, Full Metal Jacket is a big fave in my kitchen. We like to riff on that, you know. You, what is your major malfunction, you sniveling little rodent dropping, you know, that sort of thing.
You betcha, yeah. You betcha. A man I worked for, also in Lake Placid, who was, well, if you picture the type, a grown-up line cook in a commercial operation, explained chef's temperament this way, you know, the knife throwing, the swearing, the whatever, that unlike other people that build things and build them well, whatever we do turns to crap within hours.
Yeah, there's that. And I just was reading something about why chefs are so crazed. It's that, you know, people don't understand us, but we don't really understand them. I mean, a contractor comes and says, the kitchen won't be ready in time or this won't be delivered on time. That is unthinkable to a chef. You know, to us, everything must be on time.
I saw a chef, and you talk about the heat of the moment in the trenches. Some guy who comes waltzing in looking for a job, and he just waltzes in during the heat of the first rush of the evening, and what?
I knew that was coming.
12-inch chef knife goes straight into the floor and snaps off.
Love it.
The guy stands there going, huh? Well, what's the matter? Get out. Get out before you're dead.
Basil, thank you. That's the real thing.
I saw a chef leap across the line, bite a waiter on the nose, and shake him like a dog. That was the roughest thing I've ever seen.
1-800-423-8255. The people that fix your food, Connectionless News, in the very, very best restaurants. Do you want to know them? Nick is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Nick.
Yes.
Welcome.
How are you doing?
Good.
I just this is more of a story of my wife's where she when she worked in a restaurant was probably a 3-star restaurant, and the owner and head chef was, I mean, he was a good guy but not the best cook in the world, and thankfully never worked on the nights or weekends, but the restaurant basically would have fallen apart without his chief line cook, who cooked much better than he did, and this guy was probably should have been in prison. He had more DUIs than you can count on one hand. And this, without this kind of borderline personality, this very successful restaurant would have been, would have closed. So
that's very common practice. Many of the really talented cooks I know, I mean, inside the kitchen doors, they perform brilliantly. They show up on time. They do everything right. They deal with my food with sensitivity and care. Outside the kitchen doors, they would probably be, would be wise to keep them under close supervision.
You mentioned somewhere that the most commonly listed civilian occupation for men in prison is cook.
So I've been told, yeah.
Another urban legend of the food biz. 1-800-423-8255 makes the kitchen confidential connection with Anthony Bourdain. Gavin is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello.
Hello, Gavin.
Hi. Great show. Great subject.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that before returning to my work in the theater as a theater manager, that I was a manager of a restaurant here in Louisville, and that I found that dealing with the kitchen staff and the people in general was much like managing actors and performers. I mean, we did a lot of things in front of the dining public that were just, you know, incredible feats of performance. And really, as artisans, the staff and the chefs wanted to be treated that way.
There's a lot of, certainly the front of the house is a lot of theatrical aspects, and in the back of the house is certainly a lot of psychodrama.
Oh, psychodrama, yes. Yes, indeed. I often thought that I was working in a sort of a mental health outpatient care thing going on with the variety of people that you would meet. But you were absolutely right earlier when you were talking about the various employees that have worked their way up from, you know, positions that I, as an American, you know, never would have thought about taking or whatnot. Yet when I looked into the people that I, you know, wanted to work with and wanted to be able to rely on, it was always the person that had worked their way up from the bottom.
Yep.
Would you talk a little bit about sort of front of the house, back of the house, the sort of Jekyll and Hyde division of labors here, chaos in one space, cordiality in another?
Well, you know, that it's funny, if you read Orwell describing a restaurant or a kitchen in 1928, the relationship between the front of the house and the back of the house, meaning the floor staff, what goes on in the dining room, front of the house management, waiters, busboys, and the back of the house, meaning the kitchen, nothing has changed. You know, there's incredible antagonism oft times during the shift, and yet afterwards, most times, all is forgiven. During the shift, the cooks are very aware of the fact that the floor is generally making more money, and they use their limited power during that time period to bully and bludgeon the floor as much as possible, because, of course, they control their fate at that point and only at that point. But after the shift, it's a one big, happy, dysfunctional family again.
1-800-423-8255. Anthony Bourdain's tell-all revelation of the real world of the best restaurants. Diane is calling from Chester, New Hampshire.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to thank your guest for telling the candid, honest side of the business. I'm someone who's very young, worked my way up, and started my career at Donutland down in Maynard, Massachusetts, and actually did fine dining, wore the tuxedo dress, and, you know, had the fine dining experience. But I enjoy those down-to-earth places where you've got the Brazilians and Mexicans working side by side in the trenches with you. And those are the people that I count on. And I remember fondly somebody named Joaquim, who I worked with at a family, kind of like a 99, but a family-run business. And, you know, working with these hardworking people, it's just amazing. And they are very smart, highly intelligent, often taken advantage of. And I remember one time Joaquim was told to pick up somebody's remains of their dinner because they had drank too much following dinner. And this person was obnoxious and drunk and had thrown up in our bathroom. And Joaquim pretended not to understand, you know. No comprendo, no comprendo. And, you know, I caught him talking about stocks back making salads in the back of the kitchen. So, you know, sometimes you can use it to your advantage. But he was very hardworking, worked three jobs, sent money back to Brazil. And these are the people that, you know, you end up going to their tenement houses and having, you know, beans and rice and dance and, you know, really nice friends. And that's all. That's all I wanted to really say.
I think it's one of the joys of the business is that it forces people into situations where they encounter and work with and become close to people who they never would have become close to otherwise. I think that's one of the real pluses.
I'm glad Diane called in. I mean, speaking for the female persuasion, there are a lot of women, even in your own kitchens, but these sound like unbelievably macho places.
It's a business, first of all, particularly the cooking end, that has been traditionally hostile to women. It's the level of discourse in the kitchen is sub-moronic most times at best. It's predominantly male. It's a very locker room, overly testosterone environment. The women I've known who've really succeeded and prospered as line cooks, as opposed to chefs, as line cooks, have been just incredibly strong, funny, powerful, you know, warrior types who deal it out twice as hard and twice as amusingly as their male counterparts.
1-800-423-8255 makes the kitchen connection. Cindy is on the line.
Hi. I worked in a number of kitchens in the 70s, and actually you sort of hit on the topic when you were talking about women. There were two things. One, the white powder that was going through our kitchen, there was more cocaine than there was flour.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that was still as prevalent today. And also, being the only woman in the kitchen, oh, my God, I was harassed. Incredibly, to, you know, where, you know, I would walk by and the chef would take his knife and cut my clothes. I mean, it was really...
It's tough. Well, back in the 70s, it was really Wild West back then when most chefs were, you know, part-time roofers and house painters. There
right.
wasn't that professional ethic. But I would say, particularly as far as the cocaine and the drugs, that's really, really changed. You know, you don't see that as much. I mean, it's always there on the periphery, but that has changed.
Explain what cocaine does for a chef. I mean, it gets you through the night, or...
You know, people with a disposable income, often paid in cash, already with a sort of a rock and roll outlook and a piratical subculture going for them, are going to gravitate towards it anyway. You know, you're jacked up on adrenaline, you're up all night anyway, you're hanging out with the wrong crowd to start with. I mean, all those factors came together. But that has changed. I mean, cooking has become more of a profession, of a respectable life profession now. And there's the attrition factor. You know, people just who were doing it in the 70s and 80s just sort of bottomed out, like, you know, like me. You reach a point, you decide I want to live.
Anthony Bourdain is our guest. The question is whether you want to hear this before you go out to dinner. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with the real life of the best kitchens. This is The Connection. From WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
Just make me a side of the spaghetti, please.
I want to know for who is it for?
For the lady with the risotto.
What?
Why? She likes starch. I don't know. Come on.
Who are these people in America? I need to talk to her.
Oh, please. Prima, what are you going to do? Tell the customer what she can eat, huh? That is what she wants. That is what the customer asks for. Make it. Make the pasta. Make it. Make it. Make the pasta. Come on, let's go.
That's Segundo and Primo in the kitchen from the movie Big Night. In our kitchen, we've got the chef and the writer, Anthony Bourdain, who has a tell-it-like-it-is approach to the culture of restaurant work. His book is called Kitchen Confidential. You can read it as scandal. You can also read it as a kind of a love story about the people who make the best food. Make the conversation at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. You were talking about sort of sexual relations in kitchens that are sort of, it's all about all that meat, all that perishable flesh.
Mm.
I wanted you also just to talk about the pleasure of the food itself and the joy of making it.
There are a few things more beautiful than seeing, you know, heavily tattooed, you know, rough-looking characters who've done prison time dancing around in the kitchen with that sort of intricate choreography, or, you know, tasting food, delicately squeezing sauces onto a plate, tasting it, doing something. It's such a mix of, you know, sort of hyper, you know, rough, tough, and really sensitive, and there's an almost there's a sensual aspect to ladling and spooning sauce onto a plate, and you know, it requires a part of the brain and the heart that you wouldn't anticipate in practitioners of cooking. I mean, they're so diametrically opposed. You need endurance and strength and this ability to endure a relentless production line sort of facility. And on the other hand, to appreciate the smell of daube of beef Provençal slow cooking on the back of the stove, you know, it's magic.
You're tough on vegetarians. Enemies of the human spirit, you say.
Yeah, well, you know, as a chef, the first thing I do is I start roasting veal bones. You know, for me, veal stock is magic. And, you know, of course, as a chef, to ask me to tie one hand behind my back at cooking, meaning to deal just with vegetables, well, that the prospect is terrifying.
I wanted to ask, what is your, not your favorite dish or your favorite food, but what, you say veal bones, what are the processes or the materials, the things that sort of most embody for you the spiritual high?
A good chef's knife is a beautiful thing just to gaze upon, to hold in one's hand. You know, a pot of a really good veal stock or demi-glace simmering away slowly in a perfect, uncloudy, you know, the possibilities when you have a good batch of that are just so limitless, all the things you can do with it. A good stinky, runny cheese like a Vacherin, sweetbreads, you know, whole roasted fish, raw fish, you know, a simple oyster with a, you know, wedge of lemon. You know, these are all beautiful things that speak directly to the soul, you know, even for a jaded chef, you know.
1-800-423-8255. The Kitchen Connection. Cody is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Cody. Welcome.
Hey.
Thank you. I also wanted to touch on another aspect of the imported kitchen help that I've seen and been very impressed by, and it's the value of their family and how meaningful the rest of their family is, and how that they bring that kind of meaning and loyalty to the kitchen. And all of my guys are from El Salvador, and they're just, it's pretty much a big family that works for us.
You know, that's a really good point. All of the Latinos who work for me are, almost all are family people. You know, they have wives and kids. Many are related to one another, whereas all of the Americans and French who work for me are loners. You know, go home to a lonely apartment in Queens and, you know, watch TV and drink.
Yeah.
How many,
you go to
point.
School with these guys and you never see them again.
Yeah.
Cody, how many of the Latinos are sending money home?
Every single one of them. Every single one of them. And they're all working 6 days a week, and they're making more money now, which I'm glad to be a part of. You know, we love paying these guys as much as we can. And what it, the lives that it makes for them back at home is amazing. It's really a really great part of the story, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. To have people working for you who are responsible to others is an asset, I think.
Cody, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Kitchen Confidential connection with Anthony Bourdain. Chris is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Chris.
I just want to say great topic. I was just remembering my dream last night of overcooking foie gras.
Ooh.
And it melting all over, and I just couldn't stop it.
But wake up screaming.
Yes, wake up screaming. Wake up with an anxiety attack. And what I really wanted to relate was outside of the trenches, there is light inside of having the opportunities to cook with a chef in the Boston area who was a delight and offered me so many skills that I've taken on into the nonprofit world to teach youth. So, like, beyond the trenches, which I have seen, that there is light. And
seriously, Chris, what are you doing for an encore here?
I'm sorry?
What are you doing for an encore? How does a cook who's experienced that pleasure, that crazy life, that nightlife, that insane life, find something else?
Well, admittedly, it's been very difficult going from a kitchen to doing some office work before getting into the kitchen again to teach youth. It's been a crazy 3 months, but it's been inside of the opportunity to do some organic farming and see vegetables grown from seed, which I think most cooks and chefs sometimes just don't get the opportunity to do or see. And when you get the opportunity to see a plant grown from seed and see it through its life cycle, you really gain that total appreciation for our local food system and how good we really have it.
I couldn't ever leave the business, I don't think. I'd miss the mosh pit, you know. I couldn't do it. I need the noise and the action and the adrenaline.
Do you recommend watching a plant grow from seed?
I do that on my day off, you know. I can't. I couldn't.
Can I just ask you, and Chris, you may have a thought on this, but Anthony Bourdain,
Is it possible to have a life when you're working this kind of
not really
submarine?
I don't think so. I have a very, very minimal life outside of the restaurant. You know, I operate in that world, and you know, Friday, Saturday nights out, holidays out. You know, you're working. Day off, you're semi-comatose. I'm not a lot of fun off the job.
Chris, how about you?
I have a life, but inside of that life is the intense joy of missing that harried lifestyle of line cooking. And just relating to earlier the conversation about veal bones, there's nothing like the smell and aroma of veal bones roasting in an oven. There's nothing like those things that you mentioned before. And what ends up happening is I end up going home and recreating what I've been thinking about all day and cooking, you know, gourmet meals for myself and my fiance, and really getting down to the nitty-gritty. And the amazing thing is when I'm in there cooking, like, there's no conversation with me. I am so focused on what's going on that I don't want to be talking about anything other than the food I'm preparing.
Chris, thank you for calling The Connection. 1-800-423-8255. Jamie is on the line.
Hi,
hi, Jamie.
About the show.
Thank
I'm
you.
So happy that you're doing this show. I'm an owner's daughter, and I've seen it from since I was a toddler to now at being 27. I've seen the drugs, the sex, the craziness, and the look on people's faces when they get a perfect meal too. So I'm just happy that everybody is seeing the reality, because when somebody's sitting in a restaurant and they're waiting for their food, they don't realize the process of what that dish had to go to get to their table.
A lot of blood, sweat, and tears getting there.
Exactly. And as you were saying before, you know, it's really difficult to leave the business. My family has three restaurants, and one of them is in North Conway, New Hampshire, and I'm living here in the Boston area trying to make it as a writer. But I'm up there in the summer now because they need me. And I just, there's really no escaping it. And I guess there's only going to be a time when I have to say to myself, yes, this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life.
I know the feeling.
I'm just trying to avoid it as long as possible.
Keep writing, Jamie. 1-800-423-8255. Can I just say, nothing is quite what it seems, even in the very best restaurants. You say, you've written that you've seen cooks make black truffles, so-called, out of portobello mushroom gills, doused with a little truffle oil, and you don't see anything too hideously wrong with that.
No.
If the circumstances were, you know, demanding.
Well, yeah.
What wouldn't you do?
I wouldn't microwave a steak. I wouldn't lean on a steak to squeeze the blood out. You know, I wouldn't serve a nasty piece of fish that's, you know, clearly bad. You know, I wouldn't cheat the customer. You know, deliberately cheat them, substitute a crummy, inexpensive item, and advertise something else. I mean, there's so many, you know, things that you see. I don't follow the three-second rule, for instance. Something hits the floor in my kitchen, it goes out. But, you know, there's something called the three-second rule you see heard about across the country, whereas basically if you catch it on the bounce, it's good to go.
1-800-423-8255, The Kitchen Confidential Connection. John is calling from Newton, Massachusetts.
Hi, how are you?
Good, John.
I worked in a Boston area kitchen for 6 months, and the chef, Roxanne Howe, taught me just everything I know about cooking and just a great love of cooking. But I just wanted to pick up on two things people have been talking about. One is the utter intensity, and I just had to quit. I didn't actually cook. I made all the cold food, and I expedited. And after 6 months, I hated every waitress in the first 5 minutes. And I was like, you know, that's okay at the end of an 8-hour shift, but in the first 5 minutes, I couldn't hack it. But my other
just why, John? Was it because they were making more money than you?
Well, that was part of it. It was definitely a front of the house, back of the house thing. Was that, you know, I felt like my job was one with nobility and honor. That is, like, I created food, and then I felt like these waitresses were sort of servile creatures whose job it was to suck up to the bigwigs.
You get paranoid. You feel like an air traffic controller, and that every plane that's coming in the airport is sent there by Satan to get you. You know,
exactly.
All messed up.
I'm putting the orders together, and a waitress grabs the wrong plate by mistake, and it's like, it's just screwed up my next, you know, hour, and I have to deal with it. And so, So there was front of the house, back of the house, and you know, yeah, they make more money. And then it's just the speed, the intensity. You get burned a lot. I mean, it's
but you get hooked on it. You get hooked on it. You're producing all that adrenaline and you know, getting your pulse rate up and down and those jagged peaks and valleys is something.
Well, my wife will tell you, it's like Chris was saying earlier, when I cook at home now, it's like, get out of the kitchen. I'm in the kitchen. Get out. You know, and
it's tough to come out of that mode, too, at the end of the day.
Yeah,
you know, when you
leave
the kitchen, it takes around 2-3 hours before you can sort of associate with normal people again.
That's why people drank so much, I think.
Yeah, that's still definitely a factor in the business.
But I just couldn't hack it. But my question is, when I was working, we had a lot of Brazilians who were busing and doing dishes and so on and so forth. And you guys were talking earlier about Latino workers in particular in the kitchen. My question is, you know, this was about 10 years ago. Has the business changed in terms of opportunity for those folks? Because when I was there, you know, there were a couple of Latino workers who, you know, one guy did cold food with me, but nobody was being trained to cook on the line, and it really felt like kind of a hierarchy. We loved these guys, but we didn't know them that well, you know. Mm-hmm. One guy, I brought in a harmonica one night, and one guy grabs my harmonica. The guy's a virtuoso, you know. I would have had no idea.
Oh, a lot of the guys I've been working with over the years from Ecuador, for instance, have, you know, have engineering degrees. They speak three languages, you know. It is foolish to underestimate them. I would say, yeah, things have changed. These people are absolutely working on the line. There is definitely a ceiling, however. You know, they can get up to sous chef, but a lot of owners are reluctant to let them out on the floor. You know, at a restaurant, a French restaurant, to have a Mexican guy walking around out in the dining room is terrifying to some owners, sadly.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. I mean,
I'd like to see that change.
Yeah. Thanks a lot,
John. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. The Kitchen Connection. Jean is on the line.
Hi. I feel like I have to defend myself as a former waitress after that last call. So here goes. A couple of points. One is, when I was working, this was, again, some time ago before things obviously have changed, but anyone who did not speak English was at bused tables, and along with the very few females, and there were very few of us, it was a fancy Boston restaurant, and mostly men were waiters, but the women and the table bussers all ate before people came, and we had to have take off the tablecloth. And the other thing I wanted to say before my phone goes off is that, problematically, the mama would come up and hit us on our knees if our skirts were too short, and so it was very exciting to talk to the back of the kitchen and to talk to the people who made the food, and it became very daring. And so I had an experience as a waitress that I was one of the minority, and I was appreciated, but I certainly wasn't allowed any more privileges. I'll get off the phone and listen to your answer.
Gene, thank you.
Life is, stuff goes on in the restaurant business that would be absolutely forbidden elsewhere. You know, it's all sorts of, it's a tough business for women. You know, I agree with everything you said. I mean, it's very true.
Gene, thank you. Don't take any of those remarks about waitresses personally either.
Yeah.
1-800-423-8255. The Kitchen Confidential Connection with the chef and writer, Anthony Bourdain. Ken is on the line.
Hi, Chris. This is a great show. God,
welcome.
I don't know where to begin listening to this guy. I used to, and I have to defend myself. I'm one of the front of the house guys who is always running in the back, and I hope not taking the wrong plate off the hotline. A couple of places I worked at, if you took the wrong plate off, there would be a knife coming down and smash your fingers off if you picked up the wrong plate. I have a couple of comments about another perspective. My wife is a chef, and there are two things that I've noticed, one of which is, first of all, I completely agree with this supercharged sexual environment that I cannot imagine existing anyplace except in a kitchen. You know, given the restrictions that exist in a corporate workplace today, the type of badinage that goes back and forth between men and women, cooks and waitstaff, I can't imagine that it would be allowed to take
place. Ken, who would know what to do with a sexual harassment suit in a kitchen?
Well, I think that people are aware of that stuff now. I mean,
you know, in most kitchens I work with, everybody knows everything about everyone else. We speak extremely frankly. There isn't any harassment, as such, but the level of discourse is extremely frank. We all know, you know, who got lucky last night, but male or female, we talk about it. Every aspect. I mean, we're bored. We spend 12 hours a day together. There's no time for illusion or artifice. We're talking in very blunt terms about everything from, you know, skin lesions to who got lucky the night before.
You know, it's really interesting because my wife's kitchens have varied sometimes where they're all men, sometimes all women mixed. It just, you know, depends upon what the state is at any given point. But one thing that I've noticed that's pretty interesting is what a haven kitchens often provide for people with learning disabilities. There is something that is concrete and tactile and sensual and also immediate in terms of feedback. I mean, if you're cooking
yeah.
something, if you're putting something together, it's either right or it's wrong, and there are ways of doing it, and people can follow that.
There's a very the business attracts people who are into instant gratification. You know, you make a nice dish, you're thanked for it, or you get feedback right away, and that I think carries over into the social lives of chefs and restaurant people as well. You want gratification now without a lot of preamble.
Let me just also ask Mr. Wardan something. Do you have kids?
I do not.
Uh-huh. One thing that I've also noticed over time is there seems to be sort of a cutoff point after a while because there's an issue of family life that eventually comes up.
Yeah, no, I just, it's not something I have time for or would be good at, I think.
Ken, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, The Kitchen Connection. Mark is calling from Chestertown, New York.
Hello.
Welcome, Mark.
Hi.
Boy, your show is really opening up a floodgate of emotion for me.
You'll never eat out again, Mark. Go ahead.
I'm a restaurant brat, I suppose, in that I grew up in the restaurant business in eastern Pennsylvania and remember at the age of 7 doing dishes for, you know, 8 hours a day until I think the child labor laws were passed. But I wanted to say that I have memories of my father who, and I think maybe today there's a new class of restaurant owner. I don't know. I left the business years ago. And in fact, I like to say I ran away from home at the age of 30. But my father was probably a multimillionaire as a result of his, persistence in the business. And yet, it was nothing to see him under the dishwasher,
yeah,
you know, mainly holding it together with bailing.
You see a lot of that.
The busiest time of the day.
You see a lot of that. You know, being a restaurant owner requires total commitment. That's something I would never do. It's like being a chef has eaten up all of my life. To be an owner would be it's a complete and total commitment required.
Mark, that's what they meant by System D. Interesting question. You wouldn't want to own your own restaurant.
No, I'm too young to die. I've seen it destroy too many good people. The odds are hideously stacked against you. There's so many things that could go wrong. I like to provide honest work, honest toil for an honest dollar, and, you know, maybe get a few minutes of peace of mind every 24 hours.
But are you talking about odds stacked against them in terms of
the success, the eventual success?
Coming out of it with more money that you put in.
I think you would probably enjoy better odds at the track. I mean, it's a very tough, you know, business to make a dollar in. You know, it's a labor of love, not of generally not a profit-making venture.
1-800-423-8255. Bob is on the line.
Hi there. I am wondering what is going on in the kitchen. You know, when things are really going wrong, when there are orders back there that are an hour and a half old, and customers are becoming frustrated and threatening to leave, and managers are coming in, and you know what. What sort of nightmares sort of precipitate that kind of a
how bad can it get?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my whole life is constructed around not letting that ever happen. I mean, I live in this sort of adrenaline jacked state because that has happened to me early in my career, and everything is now organized around not letting that happen.
What was the worst of it?
I mean, just to be backed up when the kitchen goes quiet. Okay, when the waiters are hiding in the kitchen and no one's yelling, nobody's screaming, everyone's just standing there in silent dread, that's, you're in the weeds, as they say, totally in the weeds. You know, the line has gone down, and that's something we avoid at all costs.
What brings it on?
Just a very bad combination of factors, all occurring at once, and that can happen, and you find yourself in the weeds.
What is it about this conversation that makes me hungry? It's lunchtime. Anthony Bourdain, thank you enormously for joining us.
My pleasure.
The book tells the truth. Everybody confirms. All sorts of people from the biz have confirmed at this hour that this is the truth about the best kitchens. And you can deal with it. Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly by Anthony Bourdain. Thank you. We had help today from Gavin Steckler, Matt Lieber, Brian Myers, Doug Sugarts, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Dan First, Hitesh Hatti, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our chef. I'm Christopher Lydon. I just work here. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. Coming up next, Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental Rugs. Three generations spent educating people in the art and culture of Oriental rugs.